Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 28th day of March, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And while the mainstream media meltdown continues, they're being revealed increasingly for the frauds that they not only are, but have been for a long, long time now. Maybe it's important to begin again today by asking, what is it that's not being covered? Starting in this case with the invasion from the south, where at least the Mexican government and press is reporting that what they're calling the Caravana Madre, the mother of all caravans, is forming right now in Honduras, and they're warning about maybe 20,000 or so more invaders heading north. As Kristen Taylor at the Gateway Pundit summarizes it, Mexican Interior Minister Olga Sanchez Cordero sounded the alarm in a tweet on Tuesday, saying, as translated, that Mexico will deploy measures at the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, migratory stations and police, to contain the Central American migrants, adding, "We can't have hundreds of thousands of migrants transiting through Mexico, reaching the northern border with the U.S." She went on to say that Mexico will no longer give large numbers of humanitarian visas to migrants crossing through the country, and that Mexico will continue to give worker or tourist visas, hopefully to keep migrants in southern Mexico and enforce migratory laws for those trying to travel north. El Economista reported that she said it's known that at least 2,400 people have already joined a new caravan in Honduras, and that if the situation continues, at the end of the year, there would be close to 900,000 migrants crossing into the United States, which represents a complex situation for Mexico as a transit country. In a related piece, Zero Hedge observes it's been several months since President Trump last threatened to close the southern border, but given yet another migrant caravan of 2,500 Central American and Cuban migrants already making its way through southern Mexico, where this group has reportedly at least received a cooler welcome than previous anti-American globalist-funded groups, that's probably a good way to put it, the president's decided it's time to revive those threats, and in a tweet early Thursday morning, Trump lashed out at Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras for doing, quote, nothing to help stop the flow of illegal migrants, adding that they're all talk and no actions, saying they've taken our money for years, but nothing has changed. So with the number of migrants now crossing the southern border surging to crisis levels, a fact that even the WAPO and New York Times have begun to acknowledge, Trump says it may again be necessary to, quote, close the southern border. The nation of India may have suddenly joined the elite club of space powers capable of shooting down satellites. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is pulling out all the stops, says another story, to ensure victory in what he called the biggest election in human history, beginning in 2 weeks there, when the newly chipped Indians take to the polls to elect, maybe, a government. In an announcement that took the world by surprise leading up to it, Modi said on Wednesday India had now successfully shot down a satellite during a recent missile test. And if accurate, although the claims have yet to be verified, that would mean India has joined the elite group of nations, including Russia, China, and the U.S., that have the ability to shoot down enemy satellites, communication, and others. Raising the question, says Tyler Durden in Zero Hedge, about the weaponization of space, just as India's regional rivalry with China, against which it's struggling for regional supremacy, is heating up. Analysts, conclude the piece, have warned that the test would ratchet up tensions between India and China, while others indicated their surprise at Modi's apparent willingness to do whatever it takes to win these elections next month. And though his poll numbers had been sagging before the latest clash with Pakistan, he's now been riding a crest of popular support over recent weeks. Wars and rumors of war seem to do that. On the collapsing rule of law front, of course, there are stories out about how the FBI is now investigating, the sudden dismissal of the Smollett hate crime hoax, which kind of begs the question, which corrupt supposed law enforcement agency is less trustworthy? Remember, Fox and friends were already trying to get this transferred to the FBI, it would seem, before the latest debacle was revealed. So you do have to wonder. And maybe it doesn't help that the FBI is already saying they're not calling this an investigation, it is a review or inquiry. And if we remember how it was they played with the terminology in order to let Hitler off the hook for treason, that isn't really comforting either. And finally, there's this in an update from Zero Hedge via the local ABC affiliate. Whether it's due to pressure from the entire world and the embarrassment of having been caught once again destroying the rule of law from within, or maybe simply deciding that her office's position would act judicially, State Attorney Kim Fox told the network during an interview last evening that her office did, quote, not ask that the court file for Smollett be sealed. It was done inadvertently, and she believes that it might be in the process of being unsealed, now that they've been, you know, publicly embarrassed. And the stench around this one, folks, is beginning to rival the stench around, oh, recent false flags like Las Vegas and New Zealand, although it's got a long way to go before it gets to the level of a Mueller stink. Although it is interesting to watch what else may crawl out of the woodwork. David Axelrod took to Twitter to express his disgust and did a pretty succinct job of it. Unless some better explanation surfaces, here's the lesson of this weird turn in the Smollett case. You can contrive a hate crime, make it national news, get caught, and if you're a well-connected celebrity, well, basically he suggests you can get off with a $10,000 wrist slap and have your record expunged and your files sealed. It is instructive to see who's weighing in on what might be the bigger picture here. Georgetown law professor Randy Barnett asks the question that everyone ought to be considering, saying, quote, none of this is normal, even for Crook County, where I was an assistant state's attorney. Educated guess? This hoax implicated someone very important who had pull with the state's attorney and who wanted very badly not to be implicated. Your cynical host adds, if we start seeing Arkansides, maybe we'll have a better clue how high up it goes. On the other side of the fake news coin, though, there is a bit of good news today. Actually, a lot of it from multiple sources. The Now the End Begins headline from Jeffrey Greider says it this way. The walls are closing in. Hundreds of thousands of viewers have deserted Rachel Maddow and fake news NBC after the Mueller report wrecked their recently soaring ratings. Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit has a similar headline. This is what you get after 2 years of hysterical fake news reporting, he begins. Your ratings tank, and the witch hunt repercussions are? Fox News viewership on Monday was larger than CNN, MSNBC's fake news combined. Actually, according to the cable news audience share, a whole heck of a lot larger. Greider's story summarized it this way, saying for 2 full years, the liberal fake news media relentlessly pushed a narrative they themselves knew to be false. For 2 reasons. One, obviously, was Trump derangement syndrome that he said, quote, raged in their souls like untreated syphilis. And the second was simply money, buckets and buckets of it, from advertising dollars on hype shows the liberal masses couldn't get enough of, which turned last-place finishers like Rachel Maddow into a ratings superstar, as her Trump-hating sycophants propelled her to the top of the Nielsen's based on bombshell, bombshell, bombshell night after night and the phony Russian collusion hoax story. But that was smashed against the rocks by the release of the Mueller report, and now her viewers are fleeing by the hundreds of thousands per day. All of this is why America, he writes, no longer trust the liberal media, why they call it fake news, and why CNN, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, and all the other TLAs have become a national disgrace, as well as a national joke. And it's gotten so bad, he concludes, that even liberals like the Daily Beast and various leftist so-called comedians are beginning to call them out. Meanwhile, RT interviewed the WikiLeaks editor-in-chief, Hr. Kristen Hrafnsson, told them that, quote, we've had this frenzy in the media, an absolutely neo-McCarthyist era, which is total humiliation for journalism. Who has gained, he asked. I can tell you who has lost. Journalism in general has lost. This is an extremely dark period for mainstream media, especially in the United States, and for those who cater to that market. Continuing by saying that he had no idea how the waste stream media, especially those who were, quote, most active in this Russiagate frenzy, will recover. I simply don't see that happening. In a normal world, a lot of journalists would be emptying their desks today, unquote. But not only is it not a normal world, the censorship from all the so-called private media, meaning Twitter, Two Facebook, Gulag's affiliates, and the like, continues to accelerate. Latest case in point, of course, is New Zealand, which is rapidly headed down the path of a totalitarian Chinese-style state. And now that they've become a gun ban state as well, it's clear they don't want people to be reporting on whatever fallout might or might not occur, as New Zealanders realize private property there is a thing of the past. Turn in your guns, Ak Tung, and don't even think you'll be allowed to talk about it. Dave Hodges at the Common Sense Show has some input. He writes, the UN has taken over New Zealand, and we know why, saying people from New Zealand are simply disappearing from his website. The loss of readership from this country alone, he says, is staggering, and it's because New Zealand is censoring Chinese-style anyone who is a conservative, because they're in the process of remaking themselves as a newly oriented version of the communist Chinese state with strong Muslim overtones to boot. Effectively, they've been wiped clean as a Western nation. And he confirms this by saying, here are some statistics from his very own website about New Zealand readers, who a month ago accounted for 4% of his total audience. But the month of the mosque shooting, his website numbers from New Zealand declined from 4% to 1%, and so far in March, the numbers have declined further, all the way down to 0.2%. And to buttress that, he quotes a couple of recent emails from New Zealanders, which do make an interesting point. One says, we follow you religiously, and I'm on a business trip currently to Vietnam. I can view your website there and read everything you've posted. However, my wife back in New Zealand cannot access your site. Her sister can, but the articles she sees are about 5 days old, as we discovered when we compared notes. Your YouTube channel is not accessible at all. And, oh, by the way, we're seeing UN officials in our businesses and around all of our politicians. In short, he writes, conservative talk show hosts such as yourself are being banned from our internet as we're turned into Nazi Germany, and everything conservative is now illegal. Another one writes almost the same thing, although this time with a compare and contrast from Hawaii. And as still others point out, headlines from front page news across New Zealand, like one that shows a woman in a burqa saying, quote, this is who we are, tell the rest of the story. What they're not, it would seem, is what they once thought they were. On the other side of the world, Britain, it seems, is still reeling from the Brexit failure, still in progress. One story from across the pond says a first attempt by MPs to find a consensus route forward for Brexit has ended in deadlock and confusion after the Commons rejected every option put forward, albeit with a near-even split on the idea of joining a customs union. Oliver Letwin, conservative veteran MP who led the process, which allowed the backbenchers to seize control of the order paper to hold a series of indicative votes, said the results were disappointing, but he hoped that a new round of votes could be held on Monday. Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay said the results strengthen the government's view that Theresa May's Brexit deal was the best and only way forward. Well, the only way that is, other than the one that people seem to want and the government seems to be avoiding at all costs, both of the European Union and Britain, but maybe there's no difference there anymore, and that is to just plain leave anyway, with no deal. A financially oriented story from Zero Hedge puts it this way. The pound tumbles, they say, as leading Brexiteers walk back their support for Theresa May's Brexit deal. For a brief moment earlier in the week, it says it looked as if May's supremely unpopular Brexit withdrawal might actually pass on the third go. But after the DUP reaffirmed its opposition to the deal late Wednesday night, a group of Brexiteers calling themselves the Spartans said they wouldn't follow ERG leaders like Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson in accepting Theresa May's back-me-and-then-sack-me deal gambit, so support for the deal that really isn't a deal is crumbling one more time. As a result, says Zero Hedge, the British pound broke below critical resistance at just over $1.31 on Thursday morning as last night's indicative vote failed spectacularly, with MPs rejecting every alternative to May's deal, which was kind of a moot point anyway, since the EU has already made it clear that it's either the withdrawal agreement, in other words, their way or the highway, or, of course, no deal. Food warning flags in the United States continue to fly, as U.S. grain bins, particularly in Iowa, have begun to collapse under the catastrophic Midwest floods, says a piece from Strange Sounds. After millions of dead calves in Nebraska, now we have thousands of tons of grain lost in Iowa. Floodwaters are still causing havoc in some Midwestern states, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Nebraska, and have resulted in an estimated $3 billion in damages so far. They show photos from an Iowa resident, indicative of just a fraction of the losses that have been incurred as a result of the unprecedented level of flooding, where at least five bins have burst in Iowa, and then one in Missouri, destroying thousands of tons of grain. So another word to the wise, food price inflation ahead, as if the banksters weren't already on track to make that happen independently. After all of that, we do need a bit of good news from the same part of the heartland even. In this case, it's Missouri, where their state senate actually still seems to think the Bill of Rights ought to apply, well, at least there. An upcoming vote by Missouri State Senate is expected to pass a bill that would nullify all federal gun laws, and of course they're all unconstitutional, and regulations, and make enforcement of those laws by federal officers within the state of Missouri a criminal offense. Republicans control both U.S. Senate seats and more than two-thirds of the seats in both the Missouri House and Senate, and the new bill, SB 367, and its companion House bill, HB 786, would prevent all state agencies and their employees from enforcing any federal law that infringes the Second Amendment in any way, including gun registrations, fees, fines, licenses, and bans. Originally authored back in 2014, a former version of the bill was also passed, but vetoed by then-Missouri governor and sellout Jay Nixon. The rest of the piece here from the Sentinel.net goes into some detail about what the bill contains, but suffice it to say it's pretty firm, comprehensive, and unequivocal. And I've read through it, and it makes pretty good sense. The language is designed to guarantee that the measure can't be worked around or misinterpreted, says the story, by law enforcement agencies or oath-breaking legislators. In other words, it's pro-gun legislation with teeth. Now, the only thing I can add to that is, hey, once upon a time, it was pretty clear when the founders wrote, shall not be infringed, too. But it is encouraging to see that there are still places where people are starting to wake up and say, hey, you know, we've had enough of federal encroachment, lawlessness, and all kinds of things that infringe that which shall not be infringed and undermine that which was supposed to be the rule of law. With all of that on the table, I think it makes today a really good day to go through an excellent piece by Brandon Smith at altmarket.com entitled The Federal Reserve's Controlled Demolition of the Economy is Almost Complete. And he begins by noting that the infamous, evil, unconstitutional Fed, yeah, my terminology, is often misunderstood, not only by the waste stream media, but also even in alternative economic circles. There's this ever-pervasive fantasy, he writes, on both sides, that the central banksters somehow actually care about protecting the U.S. economy or their twin missions of employment and inflation, or at least propping up the U.S. economy in the endless game of kick the can that we've gotten so used to. But while it might be true at times, that is certainly not true all the time. Sometimes the Fed's goal is not to maintain the economy, but deliberately destroy it, he says. And all of this is in view today after the latest Fed meeting at which the central bank indicated there would be a pause in their continuing interest rate hikes the rest of this year. Says Smith, as I've noted in numerous articles over the past year, the waste stream media and the Fed have made interest rates the focus of every economic discussion, and he believes this is quite deliberate. But meanwhile, there's this word capitulation, which keeps getting thrown around haphazardly in reference to their tightening. Even now, the pundits have declared the Fed is in retreat or trapped in a catch-22. But the trouble is, if the Fed was really in retreat in terms of tightening, you'd think they would stop doing it. This hasn't happened. Also, if the Fed was going to go full dovish, they might have cut interest rates in March instead of holding them steady at their so-called neutral rate of inflation, and that hasn't happened either. In fact, writes Brandon Smith, I'm not sure how anyone can claim with a straight face that the Fed has given up on their quantitative tightening, or QT, because despite the many assumptions that the Fed will eventually reverse on interest rates, he believes this is wishful thinking, and that they won't, in fact, really reverse rates in 2019. Says Smith, what I do see is the Fed using rhetoric and head fakes to give the impression they plan to go dovish sometime in the future. All that's wrongly interpreted as the Fed being dovish now. But why is the Fed doing this while continuing also to dump its balance sheet? In my view, he writes, it's because they're almost finished with the task that they set out to accomplish via quantitative tightening in the first place. And they have to make it appear as though they want to be accommodative as the system breaks down. He notes that this is a tactic the Fed has used over and over in the past, the creation of economic bubbles through inflation and artificially low interest rates, followed by abrupt tightening and higher interest rates into economic weakness, all of which is about accomplishing one goal, financial collapse. Now, at this point, your host pauses and says, hey, once again, I ask what I think is an important question. Are they really incompetent or just downright evil? I guess put another way, you could say that they simply serve another master. Note Smith, this is the same strategy the Fed used at the beginning of the Great Depression. It's also what the Fed used to trigger the crash back in 2008, and now they're doing it again. For over 2 years now, he says, the Fed's been instituting tightening measures after inflating what is probably the largest economic bubble in modern history, aka the everything bubble. And they did this despite extreme weakness in economic fundamentals. We've talked about those folks here on this show for a long, long time. And it's continuing forward until the fourth quarter of this year, despite nearly every sector of the economy, housing, autos, credit, retail, and even employment, already showing steep declines or at least a greatly reduced pace of growth, while prices of necessities, like food, remain high or are climbing. So it's not a coincidence that the Fed announced they'd be cutting assets in September just as the Treasury yield curve inverted. In other words, longer rates are lower than shorter rates for the first time since 2007, a pretty sure sign of at least recession ahead. And yes, the same thing happened just before the crash of 2008. But what bewilders me, writes Brandon Smith, are the numerous claims in the waste stream and even the alternative media that the Fed is somehow oblivious to what they're doing. In other words, that they're stupid as opposed to evil. That's simply not true, he says. Look at Jerome Powell, who in his own statements in the Fed minutes back in October 2012 explained exactly, clearly, that was before he was Fed chairman, remember, what would happen if and when the Fed tightened policy into weakness. He admits that a crash will occur. Now, 4 years later, in the wake of the Trump presidency, Powell conveniently finds himself the chairman of the Fed. What does he do? He tightens policy into economic weakness, fully aware of what would happen next. Yep, he says there's no denying. They're doing this deliberately, but the question we ought to be asking is why? While the Fed may have appeared to act as a crutch for markets over the last decade, that was not their real goal. They used the 2008 credit bubble collapse as a rationale to create an even bigger bubble that now encompasses every aspect of our financial structure. QT was needed to pop that bubble, and so the Fed tightened. And now, as both he and we have talked about before, the timing of the current crash is perfect for the bankster elites for several reasons, chief among which is that they now have a scapegoat to pin the crash on in the form of not just Trump, but populist movements worldwide. From Brexit to Brazil, the elites, he said, needed someone to blame for the collapse of their everything bubble that they've been planning for the last 10 years. Brexit has turned into a three-ring circus, a major distraction from the ultimate and intended end game that he believes will be a no-deal scenario, which is being painted by the waste stream as a kind of economic doomsday for Europe, which it will be, but not for the reasons they describe. Europe, too, has been set up for a fall, just like the United States, for many years now. Look at corporate and government debt, which is at extreme highs, while major banks in both Germany and Italy are on the verge of implosion. A hard Brexit is useful to the elites as a scapegoat for the crash they knew was going to happen anyway, and they want populist groups to get the blame. Trump, too, has been a very effective ally for the banksters. After loading his cabinet with these swamp creatures, he then went on to take full credit for the very stock market rally he originally criticized during his campaign as a fraudulent bubble created by central bank stimulus. Then there's the trade war, which has been dragging on for months and shows no signs of slowing, and it provides excellent cover for the Fed as they pull the string on life support for the economy. Even the end of the Russiagate farce and Mueller witch hunt was easy to see coming, because the bankster elites want Trump, he believes, right where he is, ready to take the blame for the coming collapse instead of the Fed. The everything bubble is at its peak. There are sovereignty activists and nationalists to point the finger at. Corporate and consumer debt are at historic highs, and the banksters are looking to cause maximum damage and move towards all of their next steps, like Agenda 2030, the Phoenix, and the global economic reset, leading to global governance. Remember, he concludes, it took 10 years to get here, and it wasn't a mistake. Be watchful, folks. Be ready, and don't be fooled. May Yahuwah bless you and yours.